VOA News via remote. I'm Tommy McKee. With the United Nations Security Council meeting Monday to discuss threats to international peace and security, the U.S. is working to ramp up diplomatic pressure on Russia over Ukraine. AP correspondent Ben Thomas.
U.S. Ambassador Linda Thomas-Greenfield tells ABC's This Week the Russians will have to explain themselves to the Security Council, specifically the massing of Russian troops near Ukraine. She adds the Western allies are going to be prepared to listen, but won't be distracted by their propaganda. Russia's veto power and its ties to other Security Council nations, including China, make any formal action unlikely. Meanwhile, the head of Russia's Security Council, Nikolai Petrushev, is rejecting Western warnings of an invasion, calling it completely ridiculous, and adding Russia neither wants nor needs war. Ben Thomas, Washington.
Russia's foreign minister claimed NATO wants to pull Ukraine into the alliance amid escalating tensions over the organization's expansion and fears Russia is preparing to invade Ukraine. In comments on state television Sunday, Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov also challenged NATO in a claim to be a purely defensive structure. Russia's massing of estimated 100,000 troops near the border with Ukraine has brought increasingly strong warnings from the West that Moscow intends to invade its neighbor. Russia, in turn, demands that NATO promise never to allow Ukraine to join the alliance and to stop the deployment of NATO weapons near Russian borders, as well as rolling back its forces from Eastern Europe. Again, Russia's foreign minister is claiming NATO wants to pull Ukraine into the alliance amid the escalating tensions over the expansion and fears Russia's preparing to invade the country. More at voanews.com. This is VOA News. North Korea did in fact confirm on Monday it test launched an intermediate range ballistic missile capable of reaching the U.S. territory of Guam, the North's most significant weapon launch in years, as Washington plans to respond to demonstrate it's committed to its allies' security in the region. The official Korean Central News Agency said Sunday's test of the missile was aimed at selectively evaluating the missile being produced and deployed and verify its overall accuracy. It said a camera installed at the missile's warhead took an image of Earth from space, and the Academy of Defense Science confirmed the accuracy, security, and effectiveness of the operation of the weapon system. North Korea said the missile was launched toward the waters off its east coast and on a high angle to prevent it from overflying other countries, but it didn't get any further details. The United Nations Secretary General says the world body has received credible allegations that more than 100 former members of the Afghan government, its security forces, and those who worked with international troops have been killed since the Taliban takeover of the country on August 15th. The Secretary General Antonio Guterres says in a report obtained Sunday by the Associated Press that more than two-thirds of the victims are alleged to result from extrajudicial killings committed by the Taliban or its affiliates. He says that this is despite the Taliban's announcement of general amnesties for those affiliated with the former government and U.S.-led coalition forces. Landslides and flooding caused by heavy rains killed at least 19 people in Brazil's most populous state Sunday, while high waters forced some 500,000 families from their homes over the weekend. Three people from the same family died when a landslide destroyed their home, according to the municipal government, while four other people were rescued by firemen. Four children died in Sao Paulo State, and the state government said four other people died in Franco de Rocha. Deaths also reported in other regions. The Cincinnati Bengals were the NFL's worst team 2 years ago. Now they're headed to the Super Bowl to play the Los Angeles Rams in the Rams' home stadium. Matching the biggest comeback in an AFC championship game, the Bengals rallied from an 18-point hole to stun Kansas City 27-24 in overtime Sunday for the first trip to the big game since the 1988 season. The rookie, Evan McPherson, made a 31-yard field goal to win it. Then the Rams overcame a 10-point second-half deficit and took the NFC crown with a 20-17 victory over San Francisco. Via remote, I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
Today is Monday, February 7th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I am Chinedu Afo in Washington. Coming up in the next half hour, elite troops and equipment from the U.S. 82nd Airborne Division land in Poland near the border with Ukraine.
What we have seen now, after two pronunciations by the United States and three other countries sending ships and aircraft and other things, we are having now a movement.
Amid tensions with Russia, European countries are worried about the flow of energy from Moscow.
Experts suspect Russia plans to use its energy supply as leverage to divide Europe. They point to disagreement in Europe over Russia's Nord Stream 2 gas pipeline.
And the discovery of a British ship that landed in Australia in 1770 sets up a debate among maritime experts. We'll have those stories and more next on International Edition. Stay tuned. Dozens of elite troops and equipment from the U.S. 82nd Airborne Division have landed in southeastern Poland near the border with Ukraine. Hundreds more troops are still expected. Their commander is Major General Christopher Donahue, who on August 30 was the last American soldier to leave Afghanistan. President Joe Biden has ordered additional U.S. troops deployed to Poland, Romania, and Germany to demonstrate America's commitment to NATO's eastern flank. A former NATO Supreme Allied Commander for Europe, General Philip Breedlove, told Reuters that the recent troop deployments announced by the United States to bolster Eastern European allies as Russia musters troops around Ukraine are likely having an effective deterrent effect. Breedlove, a retired four-star U.S. Air Force general, served as commander of U.S. European Command and NATO's Supreme Allied Commander Europe under President Barack Obama from May 2013 to May 2016.
We were in sort of a very much a passive deterrence mode. Most of our governments were saying, if, then, if he invades, then, et cetera, et cetera. And what we have seen now, after two pronunciations by the United States and three other countries sending ships and aircraft and other things, we are having now a movement towards that front area. And I think this is having an impact because remember, this is what Mr. Putin is trying to stop, is a movement into the front area. And I think what he's beginning to see is that his actions are causing the very thing he wants to stop. I think one of the reasons that we are still in negotiation is because Mr. Putin is seeing exactly what he didn't want to happen happening. Remember that some of the large demands he made up early is to move forces out of the forward area. And yet what he is doing is causing more forces to move into the forward area. So I think the messaging of Poland is very good. It's also about protecting an ally. The messaging in Romania is also about the forward area, but it's very clear that Romania is also right in the thick of this. And we want to make sure that our ally understands the United States' absolute ironclad commitment to Article 5 defense. I think the next large step or important step by NATO would be to activate or put on prepare to activate orders, portions of the very high readiness joint task force. This is exactly what it was designed for. Every day, enabling elements of that force that's on the ground continue to arrive. We've seen no abatement. We don't want to say buildup of the troops because people will equate that to more fighting troops. But what we have seen are everyday arrival of those enabling elements. The one that's talked about so much is the blood. Of course, that's an indicator as well, but that's one of many indicators. And so the continued arrival of those enabling elements makes his ability to use that force more every day.
That's General Philip Breedlove, a former NATO Supreme Allied Commander for Europe. East of the Ukrainian capital, Kyiv, people in the city of Dnipro are on the doorsteps of a possible Russian invasion. Most of the residents are native Russian speakers and identify with Russian culture. Ricardo Markina traveled to the city to report for VOA on what the tensions have meant for them. Elizabeth Chernov narrates his story.
Dnipro is the last major Ukrainian city before the Donetsk and Luhansk regions, which in 2014 and 2015 were the scene of a separatist uprising promoted and supported by Russia. From this city, where most speak Russian, came many of the combatants who fought against the separatist forces. Many of them view the current crisis with concern. Those who spoke with us chose not to give their surnames. Mikhail is a veteran of the war that broke out in 2014.
Obviously, we are worried. We have already been through this. I fought until 2016. I am a sniper. I know what war is. We will survive.
The trauma of a war that has left thousands of victims now threatens to repeat itself. But here there is a calm, albeit a tense one, with many hoping that the threat from Moscow will not become a reality. Still, the city prepares for the worst, overhauling its old Soviet-era bunkers, which ironically were meant to protect citizens from a NATO attack. Vitaly Kurdruk is in charge of the city's emergency response system.
This shelter is always ready. Periodically, we check the pipes, electricity, water, everything necessary to receive people when necessary.
Yet the city continues its normal rhythms despite the threats of a new war. The artists at the city's opera and ballet theater have not stopped their work for a single day, despite the anguish of having war yet again at their doorstep.
It is very hard. There are many Ukrainians who have relatives and friends in Russia, but the situation has developed like this. We have gotten used to this pain, and we live with it.
The tension generated by the months-long Russian troop buildup on the Ukrainian border has now passed into a moment of waiting, and with uncertainty as a backdrop, life goes on. For Ricardo Marquina in Dnipro, Ukraine, Elizabeth Chernev, VOA News.
Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan's visit to Ukraine saw the countries deepen their defense industry cooperation. The growing ties come in the face of Moscow's criticism as Russian forces continue to mass on the Ukrainian border. Dorian Jones reports from Istanbul.
After signing 8 agreements with Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan, Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky declared that the defense and aviation industries were the main driving forces behind the country's strategic partnership. During Erdogan's Kiev visit, a commitment was made to expand the production of Turkish drones in Ukraine and to construct a drone pilot training center and factory. Moscow has vehemently criticized Ankara's sale of Turkish drones to Ukraine, which were used in October against Russian-backed rebels in the Donbas region. But Aslı Aydıntaşbaş, a senior fellow at the European Council, says Turkey is also a big winner because of its deepening relationship with Ukraine.
Turkey does sell drones to Ukraine, that is true, even at the risk of angering Vladimir Putin sometimes. But it also gets very significant know-how from Ukrainian defense industry, particularly on how to make engines. This is the one thing that Turkey's very ambitious defense industry lacks. Whereas Ukraine was an important production base during the Soviet times.
Ukraine is a world leader in military engine production, from powering drones to jet engines to missiles, a legacy of the time when Ukraine was part of the former Soviet Union, says Petro Bukovsky, a senior fellow at the Democratic Initiatives Foundation in Kiev. Bukovsky says accessing that expertise has become a center of an international power struggle.
We have a huge factory, which during all the Soviet times and after collapse, the Soviet supplied engines. The Chinese tried to buy this factory, and this contract is frozen by Ukrainians. And also the United States objected to this contract because it will increase the military capabilities of China. The same plant is the key partner in this joint Ukrainian-Turkish venture to develop the drones and to supply engine to those drones.
Turkey is also seeking engine expertise in developing its own fighter jet and jet-powered drones. A prominent Turkish military helicopter deal collapsed recently with Pakistan over restrictions by Washington on the use of American engines. Defense analyst Arda Mevlutoğlu says Ankara now sees Ukraine as an essential alternative to traditional Western military suppliers.
Turkey tries to diversify its sources because traditionally Turkish defense manufacturers have been reliant on United States and European manufacturers, but mainly due to political relations and sanctions, Turkey has been facing problems procuring technologies and components from Western countries. Therefore, these factors make Ukraine a very important alternative compared to European and United States manufacturers.
Turkey's deepening cooperation with the Ukrainian defense industry continues to draw criticism from Russia. For now, though, Ankara appears more than ready to pay that price for access to Ukraine's expertise. Dorian Jones for VOA News, Istanbul.
With tensions between Russia and Ukraine intensifying steadily, European countries are concerned the flow of gas from Russia will be affected. Oksana Bedratenko looks at how Russia's action against Ukraine may affect Europe's energy sector. Anna Rice narrates her story.
About 40% of the natural gas supplied to European countries like France, Poland, Germany, and Italy comes from Russia. Western powers are concerned Russia will create a pretext to disrupt the flow of gas moving to Europe through Ukraine. The U.S. has alleged that Russia has a plan to stage an attack and use it as a reason to invade Ukraine. Russia has strongly denied the charge. Experts suspect Russia plans to use its energy supply as leverage to divide Europe. They point to disagreement in Europe over Russia's Nord Stream 2 gas pipeline, which runs from Russia to Germany under the Baltic Sea. The project has been completed, but must still get the approval of regulators in Germany and the European Union. Deborah Kagan, a former U.S. Deputy Assistant Secretary of State, says Russia's strategy is clear.
They're clearly, you know, no question using this as a political weapon to threaten Europe and especially threaten those countries who they believe might have a role in approving Nord Stream 2. So Russia's ultimate goal is to get the European Union to change its antitrust rules to allow Russia to not only provide the gas, but own the pipelines and own the type of pressure and the amount of gas that goes through those pipelines.
The U.S. and Europe have warned Russia about the consequences of its aggression toward Ukraine and say sanctions for any military action in the Ukraine will include Nord Stream 2. In order to help Europe deal with a potential gas crisis, the United States has approached Qatar and other energy-producing states about providing gas to Europe if Russia cuts off their supply. The International Energy Agency says U.S. exports of liquefied natural gas, or LNG, to Europe in the last quarter of 2021 jumped 40% from last year's totals. But experts say that won't be able to completely make up for the loss of Russian LNG in the short term. Deborah Kagan believes, however, that a disruption of Russian supplies would directly affect not only Europe, but the U.S. as well.
The United States, while it is telling Europe to cut off Russian gas, is importing about 18 million barrels a month of Russian oil into the United States.
For their part, European countries say they will continue to look for alternative sources of energy to replace their reliance on Russian gas. For Oksana Bedratenko, Anna Rice, VOA News.
Since taking over control of the Afghan capital last August, the Taliban have imposed severe restrictions on women and girls, forcing many to give up their education, careers, hopes, and dreams. But at least one international group is trying to help, as Karina Bafrajian reports.
For Afghan women and girls, their lives changed when the Taliban took over Kabul in 2021, forcing out U.S. and international forces in a chaotic withdrawal. The Taliban closed secondary schools for girls and imposed other restrictions on women, including employment. Women's lives have shrunk to household routines. Grocery shopping and visiting relatives remain the only activities in their life. Women for Women International is a civil society group whose aim is to help women and girls all over the world protect their rights. The organization reopened its training centers in Afghanistan in late January. These training programs include business classes and home economics. The group also says it has resumed cash transfers to program participants. Sadat hopes that the restrictions imposed on women and girls in Afghanistan will be loosened soon. Karina Befragian for VOA News, Washington.
Maritime experts have clashed over the apparent discovery of a British ship that famously landed in eastern Australia in 1770. The Australian National Maritime Museum said a wreck in Newport Harbor off Rhode Island in the United States had been confirmed as Captain James Cook's HMS Endeavour. Archaeologists in U.S., though, call the announcement, quote, premature, unquote. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports.
The Endeavour was deliberately sunk by British forces during the American Revolutionary War in 1778. Australian experts believe what remains of the vessel has been found after years of painstaking research in Newport Harbour. This great historical puzzle, they've insisted, has been solved. They've pointed out that what's left of the hull and other key structural details are almost exactly the same as those recorded for the Endeavour. In the United States, though, the Rhode Island Marine Archaeology Project isn't so sure. It said there was no indisputable data to prove that the Endeavour had been discovered. It described the Australian announcement as premature and a breach of contract. Kevin Sumption, the chief executive of the Australian National Maritime Museum, is adamant the Endeavour has been located.
This, of course, is the vessel that James Cook sailed to Tahiti in 1769 to observe the transit of Venus. And following that, he continued his scientific journey, charting large parts of the South Pacific and, of course, the east coast of Australia in 1770. It's arguably one of the most important vessels in Australia's maritime history.
The famous vessel was originally launched in 1764 as the Earl of Pembroke. It was renamed Endeavour by Britain's Royal Navy 4 years later. The ship was later sold to a private owner and renamed the Lord Sandwich, but was contracted by the British Navy to transport soldiers in 1776 to fight against the American colonists who sought to break free from British control. In August 1778, the British scuttled the Lord Sandwich and four other vessels at Newport Harbour to try to create a blockade to stop a fleet of French warships that had sailed in to support the American forces. More than 240 years later, the ultimate resting place of the Endeavour remains in dispute. Cook's visit to Australia in 1770 would be followed by the start of British colonisation in 1778. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
In other news, Chinese President Xi Jinping has met with leaders from Poland and Pakistan in a flurry of diplomacy on the sidelines of the Beijing Winter Olympic Games. Xi told President Andrzej Duda that China seeks to further improve ties with Warsaw, whose warm relationship with Beijing has not sat well with main rival the United States. Poland is the only EU nation to send an elected leader to the Games despite a US-led diplomatic boycott. The meeting also comes amid concerns of a potential Russian attack on Ukraine. Xi has not left China since 2019 and has met a range of world leaders over recent days, including President Vladimir Putin of Russia, with which Beijing is building a closer informal alliance. For more on this story and other breaking news, visit our website at voanews.com. Remember to connect with us on social media. We are on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. Search for VOA Africa. You are listening to VOA's International Edition. I am Chinyere Nwankwo in Washington. African leaders meeting in Ethiopia have condemned recent coups in the region. An African Union official says the organization has suspended four nations for unconstitutional changes of power. Jomo Dawit reports from Addis Ababa.
Leaders gathered at the 35th African Union summit have condemned the waves of coups seen in Africa. Ambassador Bankole Adeoye is the AU's Commissioner of Political Affairs, Peace and Security. He says summit attendees took a firm stance against any unconstitutional change of government in Africa.
So what is important is that our leaders have condemned in no uncertain terms that the African Union, the regional economic communities, will not tolerate military coup d'etat in any form.
To underscore the point, the ambassador noted the AU suspended the membership of four nations, Mali, Guinea, Sudan, and Burkina Faso. At Sunday's closing session, Kenyan President Uhuru Kenyatta presented a report linking coups to political instability and an absence of good governance that undermine Africa's socio-economic progress. Kenyatta chairs the Peace and Security Council of the African Union. He called on African Union to address root causes of the coups. The report also addressed ways to curb terror activities and politically motivated conflicts across the continent, including in Ethiopia. Ambassador Bankole says the Peace and Security Council is backing efforts to facilitate talks between Ethiopian government and the Tigray People's Liberation Front while supporting Ethiopia's Commission for National Dialogue. Armed conflict involving the government and the TPLF erupted in November 2020. Gelmo Dawit reporting for VOA News from African Union headquarters in Addis Ababa.
Increasing violence and insecurity in Burkina Faso are spurring refugees to flee into neighboring countries, adding to political and humanitarian crisis in the Sahel region. Lisa Schneider reports for VOA from Geneva.
The United Nations Refugee Agency, UNHCR, says some 19,200 Burkinabe fled last year to neighboring Ivory Coast, Mali, Niger, and Benin. This was a 50% increase from the previous year. The agency says the number of Burkinabe living in exile across the region has nearly doubled to more than 34,000. Among them are 7,000 refugees who have arrived in northwestern Ivory Coast or Côte d'Ivoire since May. UNHCR spokesman Boris Cheshirkov says vicious attacks by armed groups, mainly in the region bordering Ivory Coast, are driving more people to flee across the border.
The influx has accelerated in the past 6 weeks, though it is not linked to the recent military coup in the country, with an average of 100 people recently crossing the border daily, according to local authorities. We have registered and have been providing assistance to over 4,000 of them already.
The increasing refugee movement is putting enormous strain on the fragile Sahel region. The Central Sahel, which includes Burkina Faso, Mali, and Niger, is plagued by political instability, widespread violence, food shortages, and a climate crisis. Cheshirkov says this region of 20 million people cannot manage and support rapidly growing populations. He warns intercommunal conflicts over scarce resources are worsening.
The plight of Burkinabe refugees is becoming increasingly precarious as more people arrive in Côte d'Ivoire without personal belongings or food. They told UNHCR staff that civilians had been killed and their homes burned down by extremists. They're being hosted by Ivorian villagers in crowded conditions.
On top of the burgeoning refugee crisis, the UNHCR reports Burkina Faso also is facing a crisis of internal displacement. It says increasing violence by armed groups has forced more than 1.5 million people to flee their homes. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
This is Science in a Minute.
According to a recent NASA blog post by Elise Fisher, the James Webb Space Telescope team began the process of aligning the telescope. Meanwhile, the team also saw the very first photons of starlight that made their way through the whole telescope and was detected by its near-infrared camera instrument, which was built by the University of Arizona and Lockheed Martin. A team of engineers and scientists will use the data taken with the instrument to progressively align the telescope. The NASA blog says that the alignment process will be done in 7 phases over the next 3 months. Once the telescope is fully aligned, Webb will be ready for instrument commissioning. The first images from the new state-of-the-art space telescope are expected to be released to the public sometime this summer. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
They're still trying to figure out what are the specific policies from the White House.
VOA Asia, your daily digest of top Asia stories.
Beijing has especially hazardous levels of air pollution.
Blending American and Asian perspectives.
China is protecting wildlife.
Original reports and series, education, health, technology. Stories that mean something to your daily life. VOA Asia.
This has been International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of the entire production team, thank you so much for listening. Visit our website for in-depth coverage of world events and news 24 hours a day at voanews.com. Until next time, I am Chinedu Afoy in Washington, wishing you a great day.
This is the voice of America. Washington, ba-ba-ba-zip.